did at once by separating them. Okay? That's not a law of nature either. Palestinian national rights can be achieved if the U.S. Israel are willing to accept that.
Noam Chomsky, the world-renowned political dissident, author, and linguist, now a laureate professor in the Department of Linguistics at the University of Arizona, Tucson. Chomsky taught for 50 years at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Visit democracynow.org to watch our first full hour with Noam Chomsky discussing immigration, U.S. foreign policy in Latin America, and more. In the coming week, you'll hear Noam Chomsky on North Korea, Yemen, Iran, and more. And that does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is 50. We are celebrating our birthday with a big street fair and party on August 11th from noon to 10 p.m. here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, Oregon.
We'll be broadcasting live bands all day and have an open house celebrating 50 years of KBOO.
There will be a reunion from 2 to 5 during the street party for folks looking to see KBOO volunteers from other eras.
So save the date, Saturday, August 11th, to celebrate the 50 years of KBOO with your community radio station. KBOO Portland.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series called KBOO at the Clinton, hosted by the Clinton Street Theater. This month, we'll screen the film Undocumented on Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. Undocumented is a documentary about a 13-year-old who travels from Colombia to join his parents in America and his life becoming a surgeon. It is a story of struggle, loss, danger, courage, and love. Again, that's a film screening of Undocumented, Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands, on Monday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza in Portland. Facing America's Nuclear Legacy will remember the victims of the August 6th and August 9th, 1945 atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Speakers will discuss the lasting impacts of decades of nuclear weapons testing, the nuclear weapons situation between the United States and North Korea, the toxic cycle of nuclear weapons production, and more. Again, that's Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands, on Monday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series called KBOO at the Clinton, hosted by the Clinton Street Theater. This month, we'll screen the film Undocumented on Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. Undocumented is a documentary about a 13-year-old who travels from Colombia to join his parents in America and his life becoming a surgeon. It is a story of struggle, loss, danger, courage, and love. Again, that's a film screening of Undocumented, Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm 50 years old.
KBOO Community Radio is 50. We are celebrating our birthday with a big street fair and party on August 11th from noon to 10 p.m. here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. We'll be broadcasting live bands all day and an open house celebrating 50 years of KBOO. There will be a reunion from 2 to 5 during the street party for folks looking to see KBOO volunteers from other eras. So save the date, Saturday, August 11th, to celebrate 50 years of KBOO with your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands, on Monday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza in Portland. Facing America's Nuclear Legacy will remember the victims of the August 6th and August 9th, 1945 atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Speakers will discuss the lasting impacts of decades of nuclear weapons testing, the nuclear weapons situation between the United States and North Korea, the toxic cycle of nuclear weapons production, and more. Again, that's Facing America's Nuclear Legacy, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and the Pacific Islands, on Monday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO hosts a monthly film series called KBOO at the Clinton, hosted by the Clinton Street Theater. This month, we'll screen the film Undocumented on Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. Undocumented is a documentary about a 13-year-old who travels from Colombia to join his parents in America and his life becoming a surgeon. It is a story of struggle, loss, danger, courage, and love. Again, that's a film screening of Undocumented, Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is 50. We are celebrating our birthday with a big street fair and party on August 11th from noon to 10 p.m. here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, Oregon.
We'll be broadcasting live bands all day and have an open house celebrating 50 years of KBOO.
There will be a reunion from 2 to 5 during the street party for folks looking to see KBOO volunteers from other eras.
So save the date, Saturday, August 11th, to celebrate the 50 years of KBOO with your community radio station. KBOO Portland.
Hi, I'm Rick Mitchell, and I would like to invite you to check out my program, Jazz in the New Millennium, at kboo.fm. Each one-hour program focuses on a living jazz artist, putting their work in historical perspective, from their earliest recordings to their most recent. The current season features such legends as McCoy Tyner, Wynton Marsalis, and Dee Dee Bridgewater, as well as rising stars Julian Lage, Joy Alexander, and Tia Fuller. New shows are posted weekly, and you can also find the complete first season. The program is syndicated nationally by the African American Public Radio Consortium, but it can be heard anytime on KBOO's website by going to the drop-down menu on the homepage, clicking on Audio, then Podcasts, and scrolling down to the Jazz in the New Millennium page. That's Jazz in the New Millennium with Rick Mitchell at kboo.fm.
The time is 5:07 and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Coming up next is the evening news, followed by Prison or Labor Radio and Prison Pipeline. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Grendel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. That's 503-595-9550.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon ICE Union claims police ignored their calls for help.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg isn't going anywhere.
And in international news, millions are deemed illegal in India.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 30th, 2018. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. According to Willamette Week, The union representing U.S. ICE claims that at least twice during Occupy ICE, Portland police officers did not show up after being called by ICE employees. Allegedly, while being harassed by protesters, two ICE employees contacted police, but police did not respond to the calls because Mayor Ted Wheeler ordered police not to intervene. The union called the National ICE Council, delivered a cease and desist letter to Wheeler's office on Monday, demanding that he require Portland police officers to come to the aid of federal officials if needed. The letter, written on behalf of the employees working at the ICE office in Portland, claims that Wheeler's decision is a violation of the Constitution. The letter cites the 14th Amendment, which requires that the government cannot deny any person equal protection under the law. Nationwide, ICE continues to hold immigrants, including asylum seekers, indefinitely on criminal charges, some of whom have been forcibly separated from their families. Many immigrants being held have received little to no access to legal representation. The letter reads that Wheeler's current policy forbidding Portland law enforcement agencies from assisting employees of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency who request law enforcement assistance while at or away from work is a violation of the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. ICE has not been welcome in the Portland community, and the ICE office on McAdam was blockaded by Occupy ICE for over a month before the camp was cleared by police last week. Included in the letter was a threat of legal action against Wheeler if he does not rescind his order prohibiting Portland police from responding to calls from ICE officials. The ICE union continues, "We understand that you have a difference of opinion with the current president of the U.S. and some of his policies, but we fail to see why targeting the employees of ICE and leaving them vulnerable to violence, harassment, and even death furthers a legitimate government interest. Your policy has created a zone of terror and lawlessness." Legal counsel for the mayor is currently reviewing the letter. One of the two immigration officials claims he was harassed while picking his daughter up from camp and that protesters appeared outside of his apartment building. After calling police, he asserts that no officers arrived. Wheeler has publicly opposed President Trump's zero-tolerance immigration policy. Trump's immigration policy sparked the Occupy ICE encampment here in Portland. Wheeler has yet to respond to the letter.
Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has no plan to retire anytime soon. As reported by Politico, Ginsburg stated on Sunday she plans to serve on the bench of the country's highest court for at least five more years. If Ginsburg does serve for another 5 years, she will continue her illustrious legal career beyond her 90th birthday. Ginsburg states that, "I'm now 85. My senior colleague, Justice John Paul Stevens, stepped down when he was 90, so I think I have at least five more years." Ginsburg, who was nominated by President Bill Clinton and confirmed to the Supreme Court in 1993, is now the court's oldest as well as one of its most liberal justices. Her age and political ideology have become the subject of much scrutiny following the election of President Donald Trump. If Ginsburg were to retire during Trump's time in office, he would have the opportunity to nominate three Supreme Court justices, swinging the court heavily toward the right. Trump won over many conservative voters with his promise to only nominate conservative judges. As a candidate, Trump pledged to only pick Supreme Court nominees with the help of heavily conservative organizations like the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation. Trump has already nominated and seen Justice Neil Gorsuch confirmed to the Supreme Court and has also nominated Brett Kavanaugh to fill the seat of the retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy, who has been a consistent moderate on the court. After a performance of The Originalist, a play about former Justice Antonin Scalia, who died in 2016 and who Ginsburg was close friends with, Ginsburg spoke to reporters. Ginsburg addressed the possibility of putting a term limit on judges, dismissing the idea and asserting that we hold our offices during good behavior and most judges are very well behaved. In somewhat of a nod to progressive voters, Ginsburg offered some hope for the future. Invoking her deceased husband, Ginsburg asserted that, "My dear spouse would say that the true symbol of the United States is not the bald eagle, it is the pendulum. And when it goes very far in one direction, you can count on it swinging back." The liberal justice, fondly referred to by her supporter as the notorious RBG, isn't done yet.
As reported by Al Jazeera, India has stripped the citizenship status of 4 million people in the state of Assam. Many in the region are now worried that this move by the Indian government will lead to the mass deportation of Muslims from the area in northeastern India. On Monday, the National Register of Citizens released a final draft of Indian citizens in Assam, declaring that of the 32.9 million people in the state, only 28.9 million are considered citizens. Indian authorities claim that those not currently on the list will not be subject to immediate deportation or be arrested. People will have time to file for corrections, and a definitive list, including corrections, will be published in December. The Bharatiya Janata Party, a right-wing party represented by Prime Minister Narendra Modi, has found electoral success by promising that illegal foreigners will be expelled from India. Following the party's decision, critics are asserting that stripping citizenship from people of Bengali origin in India, the majority of whom are Muslim, draws clear parallels to Rohingya Myanmar, where the state decided to revoke the rights and protections of Muslims, which led to the Rohingya genocide. The NRC document is unique to the Indian state of Assam and was created in 1951 to separate Indian citizens from undocumented immigrants from East Pakistan, which is now Bangladesh. Any people or their descendants who are listed in the 1951 NRC final draft or in any other electoral or official documents before March 24, 1971, are considered Indian citizens. When Bangladesh seceded from Pakistan in 1971, the issue of illegal foreigners came into national focus in India. During a wave of anti-immigrant sentiments in 1983, approximately 2,000 Muslims were massacred in a single day in Assam. The chief minister claims that those not on the NRC final draft will get adequate opportunities to file claims and objections pertaining to their rights. Any corrections, objections, and claims must be filed between August 30th and September 28th. While Assam's chief minister and NRC officials attempt to quell fears of deportation, 4 million people in Assam are now left in a state of limbo between being considered a citizen and being considered an illegal foreigner. In 2017, under the current BJP administration, 15,000 people were declared foreigners, which represents a massive rise in such declarations. In the 31 years before 2017, only 90,000 people in total were declared foreigners. While the NRC final draft will not go into effect until December, those not on the list are in danger of harassment and discrimination and could eventually face deportation.
An Albany man has died in a car crash that took place this morning at 10 a.m. outside Corvallis on Highway 20. The fatal collision happened between a pickup truck and large truck with a trailer. The accident closed down the highway, and a detour was opened westbound along Knox Butte and eastbound along Harbor Road for about 3 hours while an investigation took place. Authorities are still looking into what caused the crash. If anyone has information regarding the accident, investigators are asking them to please call 541-766-6858.
Underneath the Broadway Bridge in Northwest Portland, there's an empty lot that's soon to become Harbor of Hope, a homeless shelter. However, the construction on the building might be delayed or even canceled due to overspending. The overspending was a result of plot cleanup as the dirt and soil has been polluted by the railroad tracks. The original cleanup budget for the Harbor of Hope is $100,000, but ended up going over by $500,000. The project received a $1.5 million donation from Tim Boyle, CEO of Columbia Sportswear, last April. This has brought panic to the city of Portland as the city is trying to look at every possible solution, such as making the plot of land free and waiving permit fees. Charlie Hales, the previous Portland mayor, investigated the potential homeless shelter or navigational center, but came to the conclusion that it would be expensive, too expensive actually, to operate. The project was set to be completed during the fall of this year. Ted Wheeler, the current mayor, said in a recent statement to Oregon Live that the city will cut its losses if the project doesn't work out.
2 weeks ago, the substation fire burned tens of thousands of acres southeast of the Dalles. Now, according to Fox 12 Oregon, a new fire is burning in a similar area. Also southeast of the Dalles, the Long Hollow fire has burned over 33,000 acres. As of Sunday afternoon, the fire was 58% contained. The fire was sparked on Thursday due to malfunctioning farm machinery. By Friday, the flames crossed the Deschutes River near Jones Canyon. On Saturday, firefighters lamented the record-breaking high temperatures during both the day and night, which made containing the fire even more difficult. Crews continued their efforts on Sunday, trying to improve their lines of containment in an effort to secure the dangerous southeast corridor of the fire. Residents along Segment 3 of the Deschutes River between Buck Hollow and Max Canyon received good news on Sunday afternoon. Households in the area had previously been put on Level 3 evacuation protocol, which calls for residents to abandon their houses immediately. As of Sunday, the Level 3 protocol for the area was downgraded to Level 1, which calls for residents to remain prepared. After being closed while the fire remained largely uncontained, the Deschutes River Access Road as well as Highway 216 have been reopened for use. Drivers are warned to remain especially focused when using those roads as firefighting crews continue their work in the area as they move toward completely extinguishing the fire.
Last Saturday near Fort Vancouver Way, a bottle bomb was thrown at a young girl while she was out walking her dog. 13-year-old Christina Fortner was the one attacked as the passenger of a green SUV threw a plastic bottle in her direction. The bottle exploded in her hands as she tossed it in the garbage. Fortner was taken to the hospital to be examined, given stitches, and released later that evening. Vancouver authorities partnered with the arson investigators to examine the scene of the incident and gathered video evidence and footage of the area. Ashley Fortner, the girl's mother, was informed that the bottle bomb could have contained dry ice and water, which creates pressure by creating carbon dioxide, turning it into a gas, and that can trigger a blast.
And now, it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The St. Croix Chippewa Indians and Wisconsin officials have reached an agreement in favor of the tribe's hemp business. In 2017, the tribe adopted a hemp and medical CBD program. The tribe and attorney general disagreed over a jurisdiction issue, which ended up in court. The agreement reached ensures the tribe has parity in treatment with states when it comes to the cannabis economy. The agreement allows the tribe to move forward with its own regulatory program, as well as establish a tribally owned and operated hemp business. The tribe says the business will provide much needed revenue for services and economic development. Flooding has devastated the Havasupai tribe in Arizona. The tribe declared a state of emergency last week. Located at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, the community was hit hard with several waves on July 11th, causing major damage after flooding mud and rock slides. Large boulders also blocked medical, food, and other supplies from entering the reservation. Initial estimates of damages exceed $250,000. The tribe relies on revenue from tourism and has been forced to close its campground and other services due to concerns for health and safety. Tourist areas are not expected to open until August and September. The immediate and extended closures are expected to cause financial harm to the Havasupai Reservation and tribal members, according to leaders. The tribe is working with state and federal agencies on recovery efforts. A flood relief fund has also been set up by the tribe. The Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis is offering a manual to help tribes improve home ownership. The agency recently wrapped up a two-day conference to demonstrate home ownership and mortgage processes on tribal land, as South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
The Federal Reserve is working with tribal officials to make the dream of owning a home a stronger possibility on reservation trust lands and other locations. Patrice Kunish is director of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Center for Indian Country Development. She says a lot of work needs to be done to allow home ownership to thrive on reservations.
Right now, Indian Country is suffering from a very dire housing shortage. And it's not just a shortage, it's lack of quality homes, and it's a lack of affordable housing. And so we see a tremendous amount of overcrowding in Indian Country. And that shows that families are intact, families stay together, but we also need them to grow and thrive and really create a sustainable homeland for themselves.
Cooner says the perception of Native American home ownership needs to change both on and off tribal lands.
You know, we've been trying to overcome this this notion, especially when we look at the research and data, of Indian countries being invisible, or what we call the asterisk nation. And by highlighting the possibilities and the successes in Indian country, we want to show and demonstrate both to ourselves and to the world that Indian country is thriving, and many people are working very hard to create opportunities for inclusive growth in Indian country.
Kunish says the Tribal Leader's Handbook on Home Ownership is available on the Minneapolis Fed's Indian Country website. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellen Bolt.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Julie Whipple's new book, Crash Course, about the 1978 crash in Portland of United Airlines Flight 173. At 6, it's Labor Radio, followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather at 10 p.m. will be 78 degrees in Portland. The Dalles will reach 86 degrees, and for Hood River, very temperate, 84 degrees. Today in history, the 34th President of the U.S., Dwight D. Eisenhower, signed the law PL 84-140, which declares "In God We Trust," a saying printed on coins during the Civil War, as the U.S.'s motto, extending the saying onto printed money as well. The quote of the day is from Matthew Prior, a diplomat, an English poet from the 1600s, who said, "Hope is but the dream of those who wake."
Complex News wrote that last year, the Trump administration banned the Center for Disease Control and Prevention from using the word transgender. This year, they took it one step further, going against the transgender community by retroactively revoking transgender women's passports. Complex News reported that at least two women with U.S. passports claimed the State Department denied their request for passport renewal. For each case, the State Department already approved the gender change on previous passports. Danny Eschini, who transitioned at 16 years old in 1998, said her passport held her correct gender for 20 years, meaning she would have renewed at least once in her lifetime. Yet this time around, her passport was denied renewal on the basis that she failed to disclose she was transgender, and they would need proof that she underwent a gender transition. As Skinny said, quote, "Make no mistake, this was an intentional action by the State Department to withhold recognizing my gender." Eschini also tweeted, "Today, I was denied a renewal of my passport and told that I would need a judge to unseal child welfare records from foster care in order to prove my U.S. citizenship. Despite having had all female ID since 1999, they are now demanding proof of transition for the first time." Another woman, Janice Rose, said she's run into the same issue with the State Department. She tweeted, "Wow, the U.S. Passport Office just called and told me that due to an error, the government has retroactively invalidated the change of gender marker it authorized on my passport last year. They won't renew my passport with correct name and gender until I submit a new doctor's note." Rose said she included a doctor's note with her application just in case, but it appears it wasn't enough to get her passport renewed. Complex News said they reached out to the State Department and received the following statement. "Every applicant who applies for a U.S. passport undergoes extensive vetting of their identity, claim to U.S. citizenship, and entitlement to a passport." The statement continued, "When a passport applicant presents a certification from a medical physician stating the application has undergone or is receiving appropriate clinical treatment for gender transition, A new passport will be issued with an updated gender marker. Sexual reassignment surgery is not a prerequisite for updating the gender marker in a passport, and documents proving sexual reassignment surgery are now required. However, when Rose spoke with a clinic about the incident, they responded that they had never heard of someone denied a passport renewal for a gender change.
Juul Labs' trendy USB flash drive-sized e-cigarette has become extremely popular among young people, but others are questioning what's really inside these things. The San Francisco-based company, which launched in June 2015, grew sevenfold, according to a study done by Tobacco Control. The e-cigarette is very popular and very addicting, a pack of four tiny flavored pods, with prices ranging from $16 to $18 a pod, is what you buy to smoke out of the Juul device, which itself costs $49.99. One Juul pod contains more nicotine than an entire pack of cigarettes. Most users go through a pod a day, taking in an extremely large amount of nicotine. Juul Labs has claimed its product is for adult smoking only, but several lawsuits contradict that objective. According to the Washington Post, the filings allege the startup deceptively marketed the Juul as safe and targeted youth from the start. Researchers say the Juul's sly age verification technique and social media marketing campaigns are most revealing about the company's true intentions. The Washington Post wrote about a 15-year-old tech aficionado, a jazz player and track star, who became addicted after attending a new high school where Juuling was rampant. He said the device was on the school bus, in the bathrooms, outside the school, and even in class. According to court documents, the Juul device is more potent than a cigarette, allowing high levels of nicotine to enter the bloodstream at a faster speed than cigarettes. Juul currently controls 68% of the electronic cigarette market in the U.S., where it offers Juul pods that contain 5% nicotine, far higher than the 1.7% legal limit in Britain or Europe. In early 2018, Juul began selling their product around the world. Local governments, including in California and New York, have voted to ban flavored nicotine products.
Sasha Garden, Catalina Christina James, and Tasha English, Celine Walker, all Black trans women, including Jessie Sumlar, a Black female gay drag performer, were the victims of murders that have occurred since February. The murders took place both in Jacksonville and Orlando, Florida. Sumlar was murdered in his Jacksonville apartment, where a gun was found near the door. Sumlar was found 12 hours after Sasha Garden's murder on the same day, July 19th. The Jacksonville Transgender Awareness Project's director, Paige Mahogany Park, said the drag, queer, and transgender community was even more horrified as Sumlar was a drag performer identified as male and was gay. Garden, who was misgendered and had their former name or dead name used by law enforcement, was discovered dead outside of an Orlando apartment complex. Garden had suffered through blunt force trauma before dying. Local law enforcement is currently offering a $5,000 reward to those who can provide information on the murder. Garden's mother, Sharon Jones, started two GoFundMe campaigns in order to pay for Garden's burial. The first one started on July 20th, with $510 out of $10,000 being raised. On this GoFundMe page, Jones goes by Sharon Daniels and uses her daughter's dead name and refers to Garden as her son. On the second GoFundMe page, created the day after, Jones uses the pronouns her daughter identified with, as well as using Sasha's name. The page currently has zero donations, with a goal of $11,000. Drag performer and multiple trans pageantry circuit winner Antasha English was found dead between two houses in Jacksonville on June 1st from gunshot wounds to the abdomen. English was found by local police officers and rushed to the hospital, but died a few days later. English is in the United States. Is the United States' 12th gender-related murder so far this year. Celine Walker was one of the first of the women to be murdered on February 4th, also in Jacksonville. Walker was found by police in an extended stay America hotel with gunshots through her abdomen. She was pronounced dead at the scene. Friends of Walker said she was doing whatever she could to survive. Catalina Christina James was murdered in a hotel room at a Quality Inn and Suites with death by gunshots on June 24th in the afternoon. James was also misgendered by authorities. James' mother remembers her as having a bold personality and being the life of the party and loving to dance. It's a possibility that these women and Sumlar were all connected through a traveling drag performance group.
A gay couple was forced to move from premium seating they purchased on an Alaska Airlines flight from New York to L.A. to make room for a straight couple this past week. David Cooley and his partner were sitting in the premium seating when a flight attendant had approached them and told Cooley and his partner to move to accommodate a straight couple who also wanted to be seated next to each other. Cooley explained to the flight attendant that he and his partner wanted to be seated next to each other and they were a couple. That's when the flight attendant gave them an ultimatum, either to switch to coach seating or get off the plane. Cooley and his partner left the plane. A representative of the airline spoke out and said the incident was due to a mix-up of seating. Both couples were assigned to the same premium seating. The airline apologized for the incident and spoke with both parties involved to mend the problem. According to an Alaska Airlines spokesperson, quote, "We have a zero-tolerance policy for discrimination of any kind, and our employees value inclusion for our guests and for each other." The gay couple both purchased tickets from Delta Airlines and said they will never fly with Alaska Airlines again. They're encouraging all LGBTQ people to do the same.
Leslie Coburn, the Democratic candidate for Virginia's 5th Congressional District, claimed that the district's incumbent, Denver Riggleman, is a devotee of Bigfoot erotica. Riggleman has shared a photo of naked Bigfoot with a large censor bar covering the mythical creature's penis. The caption below Riggleman's photo reads, "Cover art for hashtag mating habits of Bigfoot almost complete. I hide nothing in this magnificent time. Don't erase the censor box." Riggleman was also found to have campaigned with known white supremacist Isaac Smith, the co-founder of Unity and Security for America. Coburn added in the tweet, "This is not what we need on Capitol Hill." Riggleman says the images posted on Instagram are related to books about Bigfoot he is writing, such as The Mating Habits of Bigfoot and Why Women Want Him. The book has not been published yet, but Riggleman added that the books are humorous and meant to play off jokes that he and his military friends made. Riggleman claims he does not believe in Bigfoot. The Republican candidate set his Instagram to private and scrubbed it of Bigfoot erotic art images, according to CNN.com. Riggleman said the reason why the account went private was to avoid comments, but soon the account will be made public again.
This is your U.S. Congress, folks.
Yep.
Mars might not have the right ingredients to terraform into our planetary home away from home, even with the recent discovery of liquid water buried near its South Pole. Slashdot writes, "Nature Astronomy is putting a kibosh on the idea of terraforming Mars. At the heart of the study is carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas which is abundant on Mars. The planet's thin atmosphere is made of CO2, and the white stuff we often see on the surface is dry ice, not snow. There are visions of a fantasy future where all that trapped carbon dioxide is released, creating a thicker atmosphere that warms the planet. SpaceX founder Elon Musk has proposed nuking Mars to make this happen." A new study from veteran Mars expert Bruce Jacoski and Christopher S. Edwards surveyed how much carbon dioxide is available for terraforming the red planet. The results throw shade on the dreams of futurists.
World Cup season may be over, but there is always something happening in sports, and we're making sure you hear about it through a radical lens. Next, we hear from Not Another Sports Show from WRFU. In this episode, rules in sports around androgyny are being re-examined.
We want to make time for our in-depth segment, so we'll give you that report tomorrow night. Sorry about that. By the way, you're listening to the KBOO Evening News, and this is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503 231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Lucas Campbell, Summer Baratza, and C.J. Fritz. The engineer is Danielle Parks. The producer and KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show cover politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener calls. At 9 on Alternative Radio, political analyst Michael Parenti discusses democracy and inequality. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Stage and Studio, D-May talks to three artistic directors who are working to change the face of Shakespeare. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, talks to artists, curators, and critics. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, please go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
Good night, Rosalind.
Good night, Ken.
Good night, Danielle.
Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This year marks the 40th anniversary of the crash of United Airlines Flight 173 in an empty lot near the corner of Portland's Northeast 157th Avenue and East Burnside, just about 9 miles from where we are now in our KBOO studios. Our in-depth guest today, Julie Whipple, not only wrote a new book about the crash and its aftermath, but has a very personal connection to the event. Julie's father, Attorney Stuart M. Whipple, represented a young girl who survived the crash but lost her entire family, father, This year marks the 40th anniversary of the crash of United Airlines Flight 173 in an empty lot near the corner of Portland's Northeast 157th Avenue and East Burnside, just about 9 miles from where we are now in our KBOO studios. Our in-depth guest today, Julie Whipple, not only wrote a new book about the crash and its aftermath, but has a very personal connection to the event. Julie's father, Attorney Stuart M. Whipple, represented a young girl who survived the crash but lost her entire family, father, mother, and two sisters, traveling with her that late December day. The book is called Crash Course, Accidents Don't Just Happen, and we're fortunate to have Julie with us now to tell us more about it. Julie Whipple, thanks for coming into KBOO.
Happy to be here.
Julie, first, United Flight 173 was en route from JFK Airport in New York to Portland International Airport on December 28, 1978, with 189 people on board. After a scheduled stop in Denver, what happened as the plane approached the Portland airport?
They were very close to the airport. They could see the lights of the airport and were preparing for landing. And as they put the landing gear down, there were two enormous jolts that really rocked this giant aircraft. And, of course, it surprised everybody on board, but certainly the cockpit crew, which had never experienced anything like that before. So they went through all of the protocols for landing gear malfunction, but they still just could not understand what had happened. And so they began an hour's worth of troubleshooting.
The reason the plane crashed was because it ran out of fuel. Correct?
That's correct.
And they were doing all this troubleshooting. They had plenty of fuel, except they didn't account for the necessary time required.
Right.
Plus, it's clear from your book that the troubleshooting itself burned actually more fuel than they intended to burn just on flying around. In other words, how come they didn't realize at the time that they were running out of fuel?
I think that's one of the questions that certainly dogged the investigators all the time. There was some indication that there were tolerances in the fuel indicating system that led the cockpit crew to believe that they had more fuel on board than they actually did. The problem is they were at a very low altitude at that point. They were in a holding pattern south of the airport, and they were flying with flaps extended.
Which burns more fuel.
Of course. So they, and just being in the lower altitude as well. So they were burning more fuel more rapidly than they would have in a sort of normal flying situation.
And their focus was not on how much fuel they had left, it was on fixing the problem.
Yes, yes. And even though there were indications that they were checking the fuel, it just wasn't actually enough, obviously, to keep them safe. And I think that they were all really surprised when the engines started flaming out. They were pretty close to the airport at that point, but not close enough.
Now there's an apartment complex there at 157th and East Burnside, but at that time it was an empty lot they
landed
in.
That's correct. There were two empty lots just across Burnside from each other. They made landfall in the first empty lot, which was just south of Burnside, skidded across the main thoroughfare, and ended up in a lot that was there, at the time. Now there is an apartment complex.
And of the 189 people on the flight, how many died in the crash?
10.
Now, even with the tragic number of dead, 10 is 10 too many, of course, you say in the book that the crash could have taken a much larger toll?
Oh, yes. To me, it's a miracle what happened, because first of all, the crash happened at 6:15 at night. Of course, it was dark in late December, but it's still rush hour at that time. And Burnside, as we all know, is a main thoroughfare at that time. It was a four-lane thoroughfare. Now we've got the MAX train. But nobody on the ground was killed. Somehow they made it across the boulevard, and not one car was on it. Nobody was killed in the two houses that were in the lot on the south side. They were both empty at the time. And, of course, there was nobody on board in any houses across the lot. But the other thing is the aircraft, which is a huge aircraft, remained mostly intact. The main part that was destroyed was the cockpit and the first class section, which is where the little girl's family was. And a little bit, there was quite a lot of impact in the forward section of the coach, and there were some casualties there.
Now let's talk about the little girl and her family.
Mm-hmm.
You actually start the book with the story of the passenger Gabor Andor.
That's right.
And his family, his wife Rosina, three young daughters, including Elizabeth Andor, Lisa,
mm-hmm.
as she's called. He was flying with his family to a new job in the Portland area, ironically enough, for United.
He was not flying into Portland for a new job. He actually lived in Vancouver and was an employee of United at the time. He'd been an employee of United for quite some period of time. He worked in the food services department, and so that's why he and his family were flying first class. They were given flight vouchers as an employee, and because there were some open seats in first class, this is where they were sitting.
As we mentioned, Gabor, Rosina, and two of the girls died, including the baby sister,
yes.
also named Rosina. The only survivor was Elizabeth, Lisa.
Right.
And when and how did your father, Stuart Whipple, get involved as Lisa Andor's attorney?
It was pretty soon after the crash. She was still in the hospital. She would end up spending almost a month in the hospital because her injuries were so severe. And so he actually visited her there and got to know her and also her family attorney, who actually had contacted my father in order to come in and help with this case.
And you write in the book of his first meeting with Lisa. What can you tell us a little bit about that? It was very touching.
He was struck by meeting her, obviously. It was a difficult vision for him. My father is the father of five children. And so I think any parent seeing a little child in that situation would feel badly about it. And so he remembers that she was still a very spunky child. And when he went in, she raised up a little stuffed animal that somebody had given her and said, "He's going to get you."
So she was pretty playful.
She was, yeah.
Now, many years later, your father presented you with his files, I should add voluminous files, for the case Elizabeth Andor versus United Airlines. He'd been attorney for over 60 years at that point. Right. This was about 5 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. And what made the case so special for him? Was it that first meeting with Lisa?
It was certainly that, but also because the case dealt with some very big issues, not just in the aviation industry, but also legally, constitutionally. And so he was very interested in exploring all the issues that came out at trial. And I think that what I discovered in all of those boxes he gave me was a complex tale of an airplane crash, but also what happens afterwards and what happens to pretty much anybody who is injured in a, let's say, a setting where a corporation is involved, whether it's because of an unsafe practice or an unsafe product.
Now, after learning of those files, what inspired you to do further research and write the book? Did your dad kind of depend on you for that? You have a lot of experience as a journalist.
Well, I think that's part of the answer right there. I'm a journalist, and so I'm used to identifying stories, good stories. And what I saw in those boxes really piqued my interest. And I realized that it was a unique opportunity. I learned later how unique it was, because these days it's not easy to get the kind of information that was available to me about any kind of a trial. Most cases actually settle out of court, and people don't go to trial for a lot of different reasons. Some of those reasons are because of it's more difficult now than it used to be, and especially for individuals, they are intimidated.
By the corporations that they're trying to sue or
absolutely.
Litigate against.
And they're intimidated by the prospect of going to a trial, about the expense, about the time. It's just not as common as it used to be.
You mentioned, you kind of implied, the research that you did, which is incredible. In an author's note, I read that the story is based on, among other sources, cockpit voice recording transcripts, trial depositions, NTSB investigation records, that's National Transportation Safety Board records, recollections from passengers, crew, and eyewitnesses who were there for the crash, saw the crash, news reports, and interviews. So were those difficult to get? I mean, that's a lot of sources from a lot of different areas.
Yeah. Research is a rabbit hole, I can tell you that. It one thing leads to another. And so, of course, we have such great research tools available today.
The internet.
Yeah. It's an amazing source, because you really can just follow your nose down any number of pathways. So I certainly had that, and then of course there are actually a fair number of people who are survivors of the crash who are still alive and around, and so I was able to be in touch with them.
You write of a reunion too. Lisa wasn't there, but the captain was there.
Yes,
huh?
the captain.
He actually survived.
He did survive.
Can you tell us a little bit about him? A very sad case, Captain Malvern McBroom.
Yeah.
He was 52 at the time. It was a very sad aftermath for him, even though he was a survivor.
He was blamed for the crash. Part of what came out of that was a complete disgrace for him. And all in coupled with the fact that he felt responsible for the 10 people, of course, who had been killed, and all of the injuries on
and he
board.
Lost his pilot license too, so he wasn't
yes,
able to fly again.
He was stripped of his pilot's license, and it really did destroy him. And he was never able to convince the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, or the NTSB to delve into the landing gear issue that kind of sparked the whole situation to begin with. And
was that the agencies were trying to protect United? Was that the reason for that? Or it seemed like a very fruitful area of research, investigation, that was ignored.
It was ignored, and I think part of the reason why was because they were really into this new idea of crew resource management. They really wanted to change cockpit communication culture, and they seized on that aspect of the crash, and it was kind of a timing thing. It just really all came together at that point in time, but that was the focus. They wanted to make sure that people in the cockpit communicated better. They would raise their concerns with a captain, whereas before captains were really seen as, you know, the head honcho in the cockpit, and the guy that could do no wrong, and they really wanted to change that culture, and so I think that's one of the reasons why they kind of didn't delve into the landing gear issue. But that part came out in trial, and so this is an important part of my book.
The book at times reads like a thriller, so I didn't really want to get into the details of what happens later. But I am interested, or I think the listeners might be. Can you tell us what happened to Lisa Andor?
Yeah, she, spent her early childhood she moved to Chicago. Her aunt basically became her guardian, and she grew up in that family because she had lost hers. But the trial and the whole legal aftermath took many years, as, you know, most people know. The crash happened in 1978. Her trial began in 1984 and really didn't end until 1986. After that, you know, she grew up, and she now is living not in Chicago anymore. She has a family of her own, and she seems to be doing well enough, but she really does not... People get over an experience like that in their own ways is one of the things that I really learned about PTSD and traumatic experiences, is that everybody deals with them very, very differently. And her trajectory has really been to try to just put it in the past, put it behind her. She doesn't want to talk about it. So you have to respect that.
Julie, how can listeners find out more about Crash Course and get a copy if they'd like?
Well, it's being sold at Powell's Books. It's
and you'll be reading there. Right?
I will be reading there on August 20th, and I'm looking forward to that.
And that's the downtown Powell's.
Yes, the downtown Books. Powell's. Yeah. And one of the cool things about this particular reading is that there's also an audio book out for this book, and the audio book narrator is actually going to do the reading for me. Oh. She's a pro. She's award-winning, and so it's going to be kind of fun to have her actually do the reading.
And you were kind enough to give us an excerpt, which we'll post on the website.
Yes.
KBOO.FM.
Yeah, that's right, the prologue.
After the interview.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's
so,
correct.
So listeners can get that. A fascinating story. Julie Whipple, thanks very much for joining us here at KBOO today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
We've been talking with Portland-based writer and educator Julie Whipple about her new book, Crash Course, Accidents Don't Just Happen. You can learn more about Julie and her book at the website juliewhipple.com. And she'll be reading, as we said, from her book at Powell's, or actually she'll have somebody reading from it for her, Powell's downtown on Monday, August 20th at 7:30 p.m. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
KABU hosts a monthly film series called KABU at the Clinton, hosted by the Clinton Street Theater. This month, we'll screen the film Undocumented on Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. Undocumented is a documentary about a 13-year-old who travels from Colombia to join his parents in America and his life becoming a surgeon. It is a story of struggle, loss, danger, courage, and love. Again, that's a film screening of Undocumented, Thursday, August 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:59 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, this is Lane Ponce. I will be your host this evening for Labor Radio. I have three guests with me this evening. Two people are with Indivisible, and they will explain more about that. That would be Megan Cleland.
Yes.
And Jeff Kidder.
Good evening.
And we also have author and former co-host, Susan Stoner. So we'll start out with what's going on with Indivisible and an explanation of exactly what is Indivisible. Megan, why don't you take it?
Sure. There are a lot of things going on. Indivisible started after the 2016 election. It was just a Google document that started about kind of how to get involved in advocacy with your local representatives. And it was written by congressional staffers who saw the Tea Party kind of use it, use this particular strategy to kind of engage with their members of Congress. And from there, it blew up until it's about 6,000 groups nationwide, anywhere from five people. You can be a person, you can be an Indivisible group of one, to our group where is Indivisible Oregon specifically. We're not technically